Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. And our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent, critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly newsletter created by the recently deceased Bob Chapman. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing as well as can be expected. How are you doing?
Just fine.
Good.
I'm not sure how well can be expected, James. Hmm. Is that a high level of expectation or just a kind of an average level of expectation? Or
it's up to you, I guess.
All right. Well, I expect you're doing fine. You know, it is interesting because the internet is an interesting phenomenon because it does allow people that have some talent to achieve a level of influence that might not have been, just would have been almost impossible to find or expect 20 years ago. I mean, it would just been impossible. I see your name referenced in publications, other people's publications and news items and whatever. You show up from time to time. And I understand what you're doing, making your reports, your blog, your podcasts, being on programs like this one. I know that your circumstances are comparatively humble. It's not as if you're the Walter Cronkite, you know, who has a huge industry, a huge business behind him, that you're doing this all on your own, and yet you are having a really remarkable effect, given that you're essentially a one-man band, so far as I'm able to understand. Is that true?
That is true. Actually, I have a friend in Australia now, Rock West, who's helping me out a little bit with some of my editing. But other than that, and everything I've done has been 100% me, which is, it really is quite remarkable when you put it in that perspective, because I agree. I am someone who, in a previous generation, would never have been able to do what I'm doing now and would not be someone who would be discussed, you know, in various quarters of the media. So you're exactly right about that. But I am glad that I'm not Walter Cronkite, who, let's not forget, was for many years the voice of the owl in Bohemian Grove and said something to the effect of wanting to sit at the right hand of Satan because he's a globalist. So there you go. That's the type of mainstream media.
You understand I wasn't making...
I know.
Yeah. But it is astonishing, and it is evidence that it's possible to have an impact. One man. I mean, this is almost incredible. You know Greg Hunter.
Yes, I do.
All right. Greg is doing the same thing. Another one-man band. He's out there, and he's having an impact that 20 years ago would have been deemed impossible. Let's say, go away, kid. You bother me, you know? Just get out of here. We don't have to pay attention to you. And the internet allows you, if you are talented and persistent, what do you think counts for more, talent or persistence?
Well, in my case, I would say it's persistence. I mean, I just haven't given up after 8 years? Wow, I can't believe. 8 years of doing this. In fact, it's just been 8 years, just past the eight-year anniversary. That is hard for me to even contemplate. But yeah, I mean, it's just a question of continuing to do it and continuing to spread. And the internet has a long tail, as people might have heard that expression. Basically, the idea is I put out all this content, and it may not get a lot of attention at the time I put it out, but over the years, more and more people will find it. And suddenly, you know, I have people looking over my archives and finding things I did 4 or 5 years ago, and suddenly it's relevant again, and they think that's great. So that's wonderful, and that's part of the power of the internet and what we're doing. And I've often talked about this and the media phenomenon that this creates, the citizen journalism phenomenon, which I think I'm an example of, one humble example of. But as I've been trying to stress in my work more frequently of late, this is not just a media phenomenon. This is an economic phenomenon, and it's not just about spreading information per se, like what we're attempting to do with our voices here, but it's about every way that we interact with other people being expanded and amplified and put through this megaphone exponentially, so that even from a business level, this is connecting people in ways that would never have been imaginable before, and allowing businesses that would never have even been thinkable before to suddenly come online and connect people in all sorts of new and interesting ways. It's a very exciting time in a lot of respects. Of course, there are downsides to this, and perhaps we should talk about some of them as well, just to balance out the equation. But yes, it is. Well, I often talk about the wonderful aspects of this, because there are truly some wonderful and empowering aspects to this. The flip side of the coin is that, of course, what we're dealing with is a populist medium. So, for example, in the citizen journalism movement, it's absolutely amazing that really, literally, anyone who's listening to this broadcast, unless you don't have a computer or access to one, you know, can take part in this phenomenon and can do something and, you know, build a website, build an audience. You can do that. But unfortunately, with any sort of populist medium, it lends itself to whoever has the sort of loudest voice, whoever has the most outrageous voice, whoever has the most shocking information, whether it's true or not, will tend to get their word spread a lot more quickly and a lot more widely than those who have a sane, reasonable voice. So there are obviously the problems that come with a populist medium, but I think people will start to we are already discovering that that time is a significant factor. It's not just persistence in the sense you just keep doing something and then eventually people will recognize it. It's that you keep doing something and people recognize, oh, this is someone who can continue to do this over a long time and isn't continually being proven wrong. I was just reflecting today on how few of the economic forecasters that I turned to several years ago in the 2008 forecast, I still think are reliable forecasters now after the last 7 years of a lot of them saying, oh, it's all going to come to an end overnight, and obviously it hasn't yet. I mean, there's something to be said about consistency and just persistence in the sense of having a consistent message over years that actually comes true.
What's surprising is finding an audience, because there are so many people like yourself that are engaged in citizen journalism. And they may all be sincere, but they're not all equally talented. But there's so many of them. I mean, the people that are listening to this program right now, how many other programs could they be listening to? And it's certainly tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, including the blogs they could visit and the websites they could visit, the magazines they could pick up at the grocery store and read and whatever. There are so many alternatives and the market is so competitive. What is amazing is if you can capture any kind of an audience. And it's, at least it impresses me that way. How do you feel about your own audience? Are you a little bit amazed by it at times, or taking it for granted, or
I certainly hope I'm not taking it for granted. No, I can continue to be amazed by it. I'm consistently amazed by it, and I'm always blown away by the type of feedback I receive when I hear from people. I just heard from someone the other day who said that he's been thinking about digging a garden in the backyard for a while now, but he's been on the fence about it. He heard a recent interview I did where I was strongly encouraging people to engage in that process, and he said, okay, that's it, I'll do it, and he did it the other day. He dug out his garden, and he's now growing things back there. So that's the type of feedback that I get on a weekly basis, at the very least. And that's the type of feedback that keeps me going. It's amazing to see that taking place. And I mean, there's a lot of things that have to come together, even regardless of levels of talent or whatever. There's a lot of things that have to come together in order to build up that audience. And there has to be a space for that. And I suppose I'm lucky, because when I started 8 years ago, I felt like I was getting into this very late in the game. But I suppose in many ways, you know, better start sooner than later. And, you know, after 8 years, it's much, much, I would imagine, much harder to start a podcast and get it noticed than it was 8 years ago. So I was kind of lucky that way. When I started out, there was less of this going on, at least in this sphere of information dissemination. So I got a early toehold into that space, and luckily that paid off for me.
But the internet is so competitive that it's, what have you done for me lately?
Yeah.
You know, this isn't something where you can sit back and say, well, I've been publishing articles for 8 years, so you got to listen to me. Nobody does that. That just that doesn't work for anyone. You've got to be able to generate a persistently good product. And it's hard to do. Yeah. You know, you get some articles that I'm sure you're very proud of. But I imagine that you get some others that you think, well, they're okay, but they're nothing amazing. And you have to wonder, you know, because I wonder, I get involved, I'm doing these radio programs, I publish a little blog and the rest, that sort of thing. You can watch it go up and down, and you've got to generate something persistently, day after day after day, week after week after week, at a certain level of quality, maybe a certain slant, and then you can hang on to an audience. But you let it slide for a couple of days, and all of a sudden you're back to where you were a couple of years ago. Competitive, competitive, competitive. Or at least that's my experience.
Yeah, no, I don't really dispute that. It is a beast that needs to be fed, I guess. And yep. In that respect, yep. Yeah, you're exactly right about that. And certainly people's memories do seem to only stretch to the latest interview video or article or podcast that I've put out. And so, yeah, I certainly feel that phenomenon. But I don't feel particularly stressed by that, because my problem isn't that I don't have enough material or I don't have enough to talk about. My problem is I could do a podcast every single day of my life for the rest of my life. Even if everything stopped right now, just based on the information I have right now, I could do it easily because I have so much to talk about. The problem is the time to do that and to do it well enough to put it into a listenable and compelling format for people, which obviously takes a lot of work. And now, as a father, it's even more work. So, it's frustrating that I have so much that I'd love to talk about and say, but not enough time to do it.
Not just frustrating. It's hard to pick and choose. Shall I tell story A, story B, story C today? Which one shall I do? And then you try to save the other two, three, whatever you're looking at. Try to remember them for tomorrow and the day after and so on. It's interesting. It's challenging. It's fun.
Well, I don't know about the type of feedback you receive. I get lots and lots of story ideas in through my contact form every single day. And the problem, again, is there are so many really good stories that really do deserve more to be said about them. But I'm just one guy. I can't do it all. So there's a lot of great tips that come in that I'm not able to do anything with. And that's a bit frustrating. And that's why I'm always compelling people and urging them, start your own blog, start something, start doing this yourself. There's so much information out there, but not enough people to spread it, I guess.
Do you think the internet is encouraging people to learn to read and to learn to write again? I mean, we've heard stories about the people being dumbed down by our government, by our public school education system in this country. Do you think the internet is actually taking at least a percentage of those people and giving them a second chance for an education? And is that education significant, or are they just barely making progress?
For the time being, there has been, and for a little time, I'm sure, will continue to be a print culture on the internet that's facilitated by the fact that there's a lot of text on the internet, obviously, and I think that's generally for the good. I don't know if it's really led to incredible rises in literacy or fluency with the English language, but at any rate, it is what it is, and more people are reading than were maybe 2 decades ago. However, having said that, I think that that's shifting now as 4G and all of this, you know, super fast streaming comes online. It's going to become more and more like television. I mean, it's going to be more image-based, more video-based, more. And, of course, also we see the sort of degeneration of the language that occurs with Twitter and what have you. I'm not one of these sticklers who thinks that the English language is immutable and should always be whatever, you know, the Oxford English Dictionary said it should be, you know, a century ago. I mean, I realize language changes and is fluid, and that's part of the beauty of language. But having said that, I think there has been, to a certain extent, to which the online communication has facilitated a sort of decline in our ability to formulate thoughts of more than 140 characters. And again, I see that even that will probably be disappearing as we move towards a more image-based internet.
Well, I agree with you, and I'm sure, you know, I see it in myself. As much as I love the language, I like words. I really enjoy the words, and I'm more adept at writing than I am at speaking. at least in my opinion, not to say that I'm any sort of a great writer. I'm more adept at reading, all right, having fooled around with the law. I have learned to read at a very high level, in my opinion. And not necessarily a fast level, but I can read. I like the words. They fascinate me. But I'm also aware that even I sit back and I'm tempted by the YouTube videos. And they ring my bell sometimes more so. They are more convenient. You know, see somebody up deliver that presentation on YouTube. It's more convenient than the written article, which I delight in some regards. And yet, myself, I find myself drawn to that video. And I don't like that necessarily, but I have to admit it's real. And if it is for me, I assume it's real for a bunch of other people besides. Let's take a break for some commercial announcements. I will be back with James Corbett on financial survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask here on Financial Survival Programs, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. And our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. A friend of mine and I went over and visited a friend of his this last Sunday. And his friend is a Chinese gentleman, 60 years old. We went over and visited him. He's living in a home that right now, I don't know what the market price is over there, but it's probably $400,000, $600,000 for the house that he's living in. He's married, got a couple of kids, and I met him for the first time, you know, on Sunday. And very, you know, nice guy. Laughing, smiling, joking, the rest of that sort of thing. He came over here 25 years ago or more as a government official from China. And his job was to negotiate deals here in the United States that would help bring business to China. And he was here for several years before the Chinese government said, "We want you to come back." And he said, "Sorry, I ain't leaving." He just decided he was going to stay in this country, and he wasn't returning to China. Now, what impressed me, we talked for a couple hours, and what impressed me about this guy is how proud he was to be Chinese. And I don't mean this in a sense that he was arrogant. I didn't show any arrogance that I was able to see. But he was proud about the extraordinary progress that China has made in the past 20 years. And he said, the key to the situation, China, they let people own their own land. He said that was the turning point. He said prior to when they changed, the Chinese people didn't own anything but maybe two sets of clothes. And then there was this radical change where people could own their own land. And he said that's what really released the creativity and the economic progress in China. And he was proud of what, even though he's been back to visit a couple of times, but initially he just said, "I'm out of here. I'm not coming back to live there." He works for the post office right now. Used to have a couple hundred people working for him. But what I wanted to talk to you about was the man's incredible pride in China and the Chinese people for the progress they'd made. He's talking about Chinese, 400,000 people leave China every year to emigrate to other countries like in Africa, for example, and maybe Southeast Asia, parts of Southeast Asia, some of them they're not welcome, but others they are. He was excited about being Chinese. He could see that this was their time. And there was, I can remember, this would be before your time, I can remember that after World War II, the American people were proud to be Americans. And we were welcome anywhere we went in the world. And people wanted, oh, the Americans, they can do things. we had a kind of pride back then that we don't have now. He does have it for China. And I've wondered if you have observed anything like that. You're in Japan. Have you been close enough to China? I know you're just across the bay from them, essentially. But are you close enough to China to feel this kind of pride? Have you observed this? Is something you're aware of, or is this...
Well, I can't speak from a lot of personal experience. I've been to China a couple of times, but not for any huge length of time. So I can't speak from a lot of personal experience in that side. But I think that this obviously relates to the type of nationalist tensions that we've seen between China and Japan in the last several years. Obviously, I think that's at least in part fanned by the flames of this growing Chinese nationalist sentiment in general. And one can understand, I mean, China has a long and proud history and a culture that has traditionally considered itself to be the center of the world, calling itself the Middle Kingdom and believing everything else is kind of outlying lands, that has for thousands of years, in fact, was one of the dominant civilizations on the planet in terms of technology and what have you. It's only in the last few hundred years, really, that it's been sort of surpassed by the Western civilization. And there is every reason to believe, if you just look at the trends in what's happening right now, that China is on the ascendant. So I can understand why a lot of people would be happy about that. And I certainly think that the relaxation of some of the stricter communist laws about property ownership and basically restricting capital utilization in the country, I think the relaxation of those rules has absolutely contributed to the boom that we're seeing. But I think it would be naive to neglect the aspects of the multinational financiers and their multinational corporations that have also very much given rise to China in the last couple of decades. And I think that underlies a somewhat different narrative that says that this isn't so much about China and Chinese interests per se. It's just that this is the next, I think, convenient way for the international multinational finance oligarchs to spread their influence around the world. So I think China is going to be used as a vessel in the same way America was used as a vessel in the 20th century. But of course, as you say, that gave rise to a lot of nationalist sentiment in the United States. We're number one, all of that. And these days, when Americans are chanting we're number one, it sounds more like a, you know, you have to believe us, we're number one, than it used to back in the day.
It's more like we were number one. You just don't have the same. It was just interesting to me to see the man's enthusiasm, and it made me aware of something that I wasn't previously aware of, and that is how our enthusiasm and pride in being Americans has waned, right? He reminded me, and you know, I hadn't thought of it. It's something that declines a little bit over time. You don't particularly notice it until all of a sudden you see this guy standing up and saying, yay, I'm Chinese, and things are going great for us. And we're, you know. But I appreciate what you're saying also. He's taking pride in being Chinese. And what we're seeing is not simply a miracle of the Chinese culture. What we're seeing, China is making leaps and bounds, or they're making progress for sure. But it's not just because of China; it's because they were in so much trouble that they would work for nothing, and therefore attracted attention and outside sources essentially built them up, not Chinese sources. So, question becomes: if they lose those outside sources, those multinational corporations, if their interest in China were to wane, will China be able to sustain its economic progress?
Well, that's the question that I think China is attempting to answer right now with a lot of the actions that it's engaging in, which is why I think we mentioned last week, part of the real reason for this buildup in gold reserves, etc., is, I think, part of that shift towards concentrating on a more domestic economy than an export-based economy. And that shift cannot be facilitated on the type of, you know, hope and dreams credit creation that they've been doing for the last several years. There's going to need to be a domestic demand to basically fill in that void that's coming from declines in export in overall exports. can they do that? And how will they go about doing that? And that's really, I guess, the question for the 21st century in a lot of ways. But again, it relies on this narrative that that the oligarchs at the top of the financial pyramid in China particularly care about the average Chinese peasant. I don't think they do particularly, so much as, well, obviously, a rising tide will float all boats. No, that's not how that phrase goes, but you know what I mean. So I think
I know what you mean, yeah. But it'll generally float the yachts higher than the rowboats.
That's it, yeah.
They may all be floating upward, but the yachts will float upward faster than the rowboats. Well, China has its problems. China has its momentum, or has had momentum. We'll watch and see how it develops over the course of the next few years. Here's an article from Financial Trend Forecaster. It's a reprint of an article that originally appeared in oilprice.com. And the headline is, "The Evolution of Economic Warfare and the Oil Weapon." All right? So you can kind of understand this article coming from oilprice.com. It came from the oil industry, in a sense. And they say in this age of derivative swaps and economic money transfers, a new form of warfare has emerged, financial warfare. And they talk about sanctions on Iran and Russia, and they move through and talk a little about history. 1967 oil embargo, 1973 oil embargo. But what interests me, here's a segment of the article, and it says, "How the U.S. and the Saudis colluded to topple the USSR. The USSR ceased to exist 1991, if I recall correctly. 90 or 91, I think it was 91. Is that true? Do you recall?
That sounds right to me.
Yeah, I think it was 1991. And here's what they say about it. In 1982... a secret declaration for economic war with the Soviet Union was signed. This declaration included no new contracts to buy Soviet national gas, accelerate development of an alternative supply to Soviet gas for parts of Europe, a plan to substantially raise interest rates on credit to the USSR, the requirement of a higher down payments and shorter maturities on Russian bonds. The declaration made the USSR debt load much more burdensome, and what delivered the final blow to the USSR was the doubling of oil production from Saudi Arabia in 1986, 5 years before the Soviet Union collapsed. This pushed oil prices down roughly $10 to roughly $10 per barrel, thus vastly decreasing the USSR's government revenue. This declaration combined with low oil prices, according to James Norman, author of the 2008 book, The Oil Card, is what led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Do you agree with that idea? Does this sound plausible? Do you think this is a true story? Is this a hypothesis? How the U.S. and the Saudis colluded to topple the USSR? Was it done by means of financial warfare, essentially?
I wouldn't say that would be the only factor, but I could see how that would be a significant factor. And I haven't looked at the 86 oil production doubling from Saudi Arabia or things along those lines, the 82 secret declaration that this article mentions, so I can't really comment on it in those mm-hmm. details, but it certainly does, I mean, it does make a certain amount of sense. I mean, I think we'd have to look at other things like the Afghanistan war that was going on at the time and a number of things that that really colluded and transpired.
I think just the nature of centrally planned economy.
I think so. I mean, it was failing.
Creates the levels of vulnerability.
I think so. And it was failing since its inception, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it was propped up by repeated technology transfers and economic aid from the West, as amply documented by Anthony Sutton in his work. So I think we have to look at the Soviet Union as something of a paper tiger that was allowed to exist for a certain amount of time. And when those supports were withdrawn, it did not exist anymore. But I think the oil factor in that is an interesting one to study. And on that note, I'm currently reading William Engdahl's Myth, Lies, and Oil Wars, which is a fascinating read about the oil industry and its incredible power over the world for the past century and a half, and the ways that it's basically manipulated geopolitics. And I think it's extremely important that we look into that, because I think the oligarchs are still some of the core people in the financial oligarchy. And obviously, you know, that's where the Rockefeller came from, the Rockefeller name, basically.
Yeah, but how is that oligarchy going to hold its power together if the dollar's status as the world's petrocurrency continues to erode? Oil will certainly remain a major player, but will it still be what might be the predominant player if the dollar and the United States loses its status as petrocurrency and world reserve currency? Do we still have that financial energy, or are they just rich guys who are in the game?
I don't think that the oil itself will be affected in any way by the U.S. petrodollar delinking or whatever is about to occur monetarily. I mean, that's just a question of what oil is going to be denominated in, but it's still going to be as valuable a commodity, barring, you know, the release of whatever free energy technologies undoubtedly exist and have been suppressed for a very long time. But barring that, I think that oil is still going to be a central player. The only question is what currency will it be denominated in? And if it's not U.S. dollars, it'll be whatever, Chinese yuan or whatever.
Well, I think for the moment, Chinese yuan is trying to be an alternative. They're not trying to replace the dollar just yet, but they are trying to be an alternative. And so, okay, we're going to do half the business and you do half the business.
On that note, just before we go, I know we're wrapping up here, but I should point out, as a listener pointed out on my website the other day, the hacking attack on the White House recently is now being blamed on China. And four senators have signed a letter saying that this is why China should be kept out of the IMF special drawing rights basket. So they're now appealing to the IMF, don't let China into that because of this hacking attack that supposedly took place on the White House, according to officials.
I understand. And when you say supposedly, you're at least implying that this may have been a false flag attack, if it was an attack at all. But that's a question for another program, because we're out of time. I'm Alfred Adask here on Financial Survival with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James will be back next Thursday, or expect next Wednesday night. We rebroadcast on Thursday. And thank you, James.
Thank you for having me
again in a week. And meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, and Frank, the producer. Good night, folks.